calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Happy Friday. Here we are. It's Friday the 31st of March, the end of March, a day after the new moon, or 2 days after, I guess, things changing. And as always, the first hour of our Friday program is our Brunch with Bernie segment. For going on 2 years now, Congressman Bernie Sanders has been with us. And always one of my favorite parts of my entire week here is talking with Bernie Sanders. Congressman Bernie Sanders, the longest serving member, independent member of the House of Representatives in that body's history, and now running for the United States Senate as an independent member from the senator from the great state of Vermont. Just by way of FYI, later on in the program, the second hour of the program, I'll be asking conservative Peter Pitts, aren't health savings accounts just another corporate giveaway? And in the third hour of our program, Jeffrey Kleinman from DVD Talk will be here with us. But right now, Congressman Bernie Sanders, Bernie.org is his website. If you'd like to check it out, and I encourage you to, it's a great news source, plus, you know, ways that you can be supportive of Bernie Sanders and his campaigns and whatnot. If you'd like to call our program, our number 866-440-8466. And, of course, if you want to drop into our live chat room, go to TomHartman.com. Bernie Sanders, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Always great to have you, Bernie.
And it is a beautiful sunny day here in Vermont, and happy springtime to everybody.
Oh, I miss Vermont, I got to tell you. I really do. I'm going to get back there one of these days.
Okay.
Tony Rudy, Tom DeLay is one of Tom DeLay's senior staff members, apparently just rolled over. He's just pled guilty to a crime that has to do with the Abramoff thing, I believe.
Well, he pleaded guilty, as I understand it, to one count of conspiracy, and he's agreed to cooperate in a federal investigation into lobby fraud on Capitol Hill. And I think what that is about is that in Tom DeLay, who was the majority leader, you had a guy who was fairly blunt and straightforward. And what he said to people is, if you want your legislation to move on the floor of the House, no problem. We will do it for you. But the Republican National Committee, or one of our campaign committees, is down the street. You drop in there, you make your contribution, and we'll talk about moving your legislation. And if you're not, sorry, it's not going to move.
Pay to play.
That's pay to play. I mean, it's capitalism to the extreme. You want something, you pay for it, and it'll move. Now, two things happen. First of all, very bad legislation moves. And the main point I think I want to make, Tom, is not to suggest, and it really is not the case, that every member of the Congress is corrupt and on the take and all that stuff. The real problem is not what is illegal, per se. It's more what is legal. And what I mean by that is that because of the massive amounts of campaign contributions that flood Capitol Hill quite legally, the only legislation that ends up moving in this Republican right-wing Congress is legislation that benefits the wealthy and large corporations, and legislation that does not move, discussions that do not take place, are those issues that are of vital importance to the average American. I mean, I can give you 1,000 examples. The most onerous, perhaps, in recent memory is this disastrous prescription drug Medicare bill, which was written by the pharmaceutical industry for the industry. One of the chief authors of it, Billy Towson of Louisiana, now works for the pharmaceutical industry. The bankruptcy bill written by the credit card companies, our disastrous trade policies, which have led to a $725 billion trade deficit, written by corporate America. In America today, you have millions of workers trying to survive on $5.15 minimum wage, which has not been raised in over 10 years. Not a word of serious discussion on the floor of the House about raising the minimum wage. Not a word. And yet hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars have been given in tax breaks to the wealthiest people in this country because they contribute very heavily to the Republican Party. And on it goes. We have a disintegrating healthcare system, as I'm sure all of the listeners know. Since President Bush has been in office, 6 million more Americans have lost their health insurance, 46 million in total. We spend twice as much per capita on healthcare as any other nation on earth. Cost of healthcare are soaring. More and more working people are forced to pay larger and larger deductibles, co-payments. Has there been one word of discussion on the floor of the House about how we have a national health care program which guarantees health care to all Americans and is run in a cost-effective way? Because we have studies out there which tell us that we can provide health care to all Americans without spending any more than we're spending now. Has there been one word of discussion on that issue? And the answer is there has not been. And on it goes.
Bernie, what about when Democrats or when an independent like yourself stands up and says, I want to talk about health care?
But here's what people have got to understand. You know, Tom, I've been in Congress now for 15 years, so I take these things for granted. I think back to before I was in Congress, and I was the mayor of the largest city in the state of Vermont, so I knew a little bit about politics. And I didn't understand how Congress works. And I think most people don't know how Congress works. How Congress works is that a party, in this case the Republican Party, led by right-wingers, controls the House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate. I'm more familiar with the House right now. I hope next year we can talk about the Senate. But right now, what happens is, I think ordinary citizens think, well, if you're concerned, if you want to have a national health care program, bring up legislation, take it to the floor of the House, have a debate, and fight to see that it's passed, right?
You would think.
That sounds pretty simple.
And in fact, when the Democrats ran the House of Representatives for you know, better part of 40 years, they regularly let Republicans speak out, did they not?
Much more so than is currently the case. But let me tell the listeners, that is not, underline, not how it works. You can introduce legislation. That you can do any day of the week. And you go out and you get co-sponsors, and that legislation is then sent to a committee. But Republicans control every single committee. And on top of these chairpersons is the Republican leadership. And they will decide what bills get to the floor of the House and what bills do not. And there is a rules committee controlled by the leadership, which can make any change it wants in any piece of legislation. So the bottom line here is that when you see a piece of legislation on the floor, with a few exceptions, and those exceptions take place during the appropriations process, where now and then we have what is called an open rule, which means, in fact, that any member can introduce an amendment if it is germane to the legislation being discussed. But that is usually rare and does not take place too often. So the main point to be made here is we should be very, very concerned about corruption in Washington right now, overt corruption. And it is worse now, I think, than it has been in many, many years. We should be even more concerned about what is legal, and that is the role that legal big money plays in pushing disastrous pieces of legislation that benefit the few, while at the same time, the kinds of work that we need to do in Congress in terms of national health care, in terms of raising the minimum wage, in terms of a trade policy that works for working Americans rather than the CEOs of large corporations, in terms of moving this country towards sustainable energy and breaking our dependence on fossil fuels, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, in terms of real education reform so that we can create a situation where every American family is able to send his or her kids to college regardless of income, in terms of a fair tax system. So instead of giving tax breaks to billionaires, we ask those who have the money to start contributing their fair share, et cetera, et cetera. Those issues never get to the floor of the House. And that's the problem that we have got to address.
Bernie, I'm curious, to what extent do you think that, I mean, these rules have been around for, in some cases, hundreds of years, and they haven't been abused. I mean, here we get this guy doing day trading out of Tom DeLay's office. To the best of the knowledge of the people that I've talked with, you, Brian Baird, who sponsored this legislation to make it illegal, this has never happened before.
Now,
to what extent do you think this is the ideology of these Republicans making
this happen? I think there's a couple of things, Tom. I think it is fair to say, you know, and whether Brian or I say it is one thing, you know, we have partisan beliefs, but I think most objective observers will tell you, A, money has always influenced Congress no matter who is in power. B, it has never been as bad as it is right now. These guys, in fact, do not very much believe in government. That's the thing.
Yeah, they believe in crony capitalism.
That's what they believe in. So for them, there is this inclination to say, look, we're in power now. How do we use our power to enrich ourselves? We're certainly not concerned about the people in Louisiana and Mississippi in terms of Hurricane Katrina. We're not concerned about senior citizens in terms of prescription drugs. Our whole thing is, how do we make our friends who contribute to us and ourselves wealthy? How do we use power for power's sake in order to maintain our own position? People like Karl Rove are brilliant people. They don't care about public policy. They care about using their intelligence and their money to stay in power, to enrich their friends.
Yeah,
and that's what it's about.
This is Gordon Gekko, run amok. Greed is good. You know, it's the Republican mantra. We're talking with Bernie Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment every week, every Friday here. Our first hour, Brunch with Congressman Bernie Sanders. Our telephone number, 866-440-8466. We'll be back with your calls right after this. It's 9:16 on the Tom Hartman Program.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back, my friends. Calling America. Tom Hartman here with you. 21 minutes past the hour. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. The congressman from the great state of Vermont. I think of Bernie as America's congressman. Although I got to say he is doing such a marvelous job representing the state of Vermont. Every state should have somebody as good as Bernie Sanders in Congress.
Thank you, Tom.
Well, I am not. I'm sorry, Bernie. I'm not kissing up to your buttering up anything like that. We wouldn't have been doing this show for almost 2 years if it wasn't true. Because I don't suffer fools gladly. I really appreciate your being with us, and you're doing a marvelous job. Armin in Bradenton, Florida on the line. Hey, Armin, what's on your mind?
Hey, how you doing? Hey, Bernie?
Yes, Armin.
It's unbelievable what's transpiring in Florida right now. This crime family, what hurricanes haven't screwed up, they're finishing off with their corrupt system. The insurance crisis down here, healthcare costs, first off, in Florida, nobody wants to write insurance for Florida because they're so high. You know, like in Sarasota and Bradenton, my wife's tried checking around, nobody even wants it because they're so much higher than the common cost of everywhere else in the United States. That's number one. Number two, they're raising the insurance. My wife's in real estate, and now they're jumping the insurance for these older homes because they're older, and they say they're more risk. They're jumping it double and tripling the cost of insurance to these people, sometimes $3,000 for, you know, a working person's house, and that's just going to throw a lot of people out of home ownership. It's just outrageous. And besides the fact of that, I was talking to a very competent agent the other day, and the agent told me, an auto insurance agent, that it's a crisis situation in Dade County and a lot of counties like around Tampa, Sarasota, and Miami, that area, 8 out of 10 people you meet on the road. And this is, I think, partially linked, Bernie, to the open borders policy. 8 out of 10 people don't have any auto insurance.
Wow.
And then in Sarasota, Bradenton area, 6 out of 10 don't have it. So, I mean, what they're doing, they're running this like a syndicate.
Does anybody in your legislature, the governor, begin to deal with these issues?
It's my understanding that there was a bus. There was 3 or 4 buses that went to Tallahassee the first of this week. You know, a lot of concerned citizens all across the board, you know, economically, age, you know, the whole thing. And Jeb Bush came out and seen him and just turned his back and walked away from them all.
Okay, Armin, I, you know, needless to say, don't know a whole lot about the insurance situation in Florida. I do know some of the insurance situation in Vermont and throughout this country. In terms of health care, let me just stay on this issue, just a couple of points that I want to make. I hope all of the listeners understand that the United States of America, whether it's Florida, Vermont, or any other state, we are the only nation in the industrialized world who has not finally reached the decision that all people, all citizens, should have health care regardless of their income through a universal health care program. And I think the major civil rights struggle of our time right now is to demand that we have a national health care program which guarantees health care to all people. Armin talks about the huge increase in health care costs in Florida. Let me tell you something. It's going on all over America. and what we can do, and study after study indicates, if we get rid of all of the bureaucracy, all of the expenses regarding billing, all of the advertising, all of the crap within the healthcare system that has nothing to do with providing healthcare or dental care to people, we can, in fact, cover all of our people without spending any more money than we're currently spending. That's the kind of work that Congress has got to be doing, and unfortunately, we're not.
The problem with that, though, Bernie, is that if you did that, you would have a whole bunch of healthcare industry multimillionaires, people like Bill Frist's father, who's become a multi-billionaire off, you know, squeezing blood out of the rest of us in healthcare. You'd have a bunch of these people sitting around just having to, I guess, just live on their investments.
And let me take you a step further. You would have the pharmaceutical industry not charging the American people the highest prices in the world for medicine while they contribute, you know, zillions of dollars into political campaigns. But that's precisely the point, Tom.
Yeah.
How do you create a cost-effective healthcare system which provides high-quality healthcare to all people? Can we snap our fingers and make it happen? No. It's complicated. It's difficult. Can we do it? We sure can. Is our present system the most wasteful and bureaucratic in the industrialized world? Yeah, it is. And we've got to change it. We've got to guarantee health care to all people and do it in a way which is cost-effective. We can do it.
We can do it. Alice in Old Joe, Arkansas. Alice, we have about a half a minute left. If you got a quick question?
Sure. I'm wondering why the Democrats don't use everything within the procedural powers of their office to slow everything down to a crawl, to make it absolutely, totally difficult beyond belief to allow this.
Well, let me answer that very briefly, Alex.
There are lots of procedural things that could be done to slow it down and to say, look, we can't go any further with this.
Okay.
This is out of control.
The answer to your question is, again, the Senate is very different in the House, and there's more to do that in the Senate. In the House, there are major conference committees that take place where Democrats are not even allowed, are not even invited to be in. Their presence is totally perfunctory. Decisions are made behind closed doors just by Republicans.
The Democrats aren't even in the room?
The situation is different. There is more flexibility to slow things down. But in the House, there ain't a lot of opportunity.
You mean literally the Democrats are not even in the room?
Yeah, sometimes they're not even in the room. Or they're given a piece of paper and say, sign it or don't sign it. Decision has been made. We have the majority.
Incredible. Incredible. 27 minutes past the hour. Brunch with Bernie. Bernie.org. Our website, 866-440-8466.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
I'm not ready to make nice. I'm not ready to back down. Still mad as hell. Don't have time to go round and round and round. It's too late to make it right. I probably wouldn't if I could.
And welcome back, my friends. The Dixie Chicks there saying to George W. Bush and friends, sorry, it's too late to make nice. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman radio program, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us, 1-866-440-8466. If you have questions, comments, concerns, criticisms, complaints, or compliments, or any variation thereof, give us a shout. Paula in Eureka, California, you are live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Good morning, Tom and Congressman. I just heard a very little brief mention on another show that there is a very little known provision that was inserted by Thomas Jefferson, which allows articles of impeachment to be brought forth by a state legislature, and that the Vermont state legislature is thinking of doing that. And I was just wondering if you know anything about that, Tom, or if you could comment on that, Congressman.
I've read the news story.
I've read it, too. And I think the Vermont Democratic Party is discussing this issue. I think the leadership, the Democratic leadership, Vermont state legislature is probably not going to go forward on that. The issue of impeachment is being discussed a lot. And let me be clear about what my views are. I have signed on to a resolution by Congressman John Conyers, which I think is the right approach. And what that says is we need a serious investigation, which, of course, we have not had up until this point, about, among other things, how we got into the war in Iraq. The president says that he just got faulty information in terms of his assessment that there were weapons of mass destruction, or that Iraq was working with Al-Qaeda, or that these aluminum tubes were being used for a nuclear program in Iraq, etc., etc. It wasn't his fault. He just got faulty information. But more and more we're hearing from former CIA people and others that that really wasn't the case, that the president chose to cherry-pick the information that came in. He ignored information which says that perhaps Iraq did not have weapons of mass destruction, etc., etc. I think that what we need is a serious investigation. And I say that not just, you know, that people should be beating up on George Bush. We need to know the truth, and we need to hear what the administration's explanations are as well. And we need to do that in order to make sure that never again do we get into a war through this process. So I think that's the direction to go. And you have to do that before you can have, I think, serious discussions about impeachment.
Yeah, set this thing up first. It's
right. Now, the answer is, by the way, that under a Republican-controlled Congress, it's not going to happen. It is not going to happen.
Yeah.
So my own view is that if people are concerned about the war in Iraq and how we got in there, if you're concerned about Bush's record on constitutional, on abrogating constitutional rights, et cetera, there is one real remedy, and that is to be actively involved in the political process for the next 6 months and see that the Democrats take back the House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate. And then we can move this direction, this country, in a new direction, and at the same time begin the process of understanding what in fact happened in terms of the lead-up to the war.
Bernie, just to amplify this point a little bit, the National Journal, this just came out this morning. Just the first paragraph, Karl Rove, President Bush's chief political advisor, cautioned other White House aides in the summer of 2003, this was a year and a half before the election, that Bush's 2004 reelection prospects would be seriously damaged if it was publicly disclosed that Bush had been personally warned that a key rationale for going to war had been challenged within the administration.
Right. And they're talking about that article. Right in front of me. I read it. And let's be clear about a couple of things. National Journal is an absolutely, at best, mainstream publication.
Yeah.
And the point that they are making, which, you know, is the point that I've been trying to make, is that there is a lot of evidence out there that, in fact, Bush knew that, in fact, it, to say the least, might not be the case that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction.
Well, can I play just a 10 seconds of audio here
sure.
for you? This is George W. Bush, and this this was apparently a year after he had been told that these aluminum tubes were to be used to provide fuel to rockets. You know, they connected the rocket engine to the tanks. They had nothing to do with nuclear centrifuges. Here's George W. Bush.
Iraq has attempted to purchase high-strength aluminum tubes and other equipment needed for gas centrifuges, which are used to enrich uranium for nuclear weapons. If the Iraqi regime is able to produce, buy, or steal an amount of highly enriched uranium a little larger than a single softball, it could have a nuclear weapon in less than a year.
And then he went on to say, you know, Iraq is the gathering threat, and we can't afford to the smoking gun to be in a mushroom cloud.
And then he was on to say, and there was a lot of, intelligence information which told him it was not true, talking about the links between Al-Qaeda and Iraq, and Iraq was helping Al-Qaeda develop WMDs, et cetera, et cetera.
But my point in this, Bernie, the question to you is, in my recollection of history, and you know, I'm not a history professor or anything, but I am a fairly well-versed, I think. I don't think that there has, even the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, it's still being debated whether LBJ knew that was phony or not. Other than possibly McKinley, with the USS Maine, and even that's being debated, I don't know of any other president in the history of this country that led us to war based on a lie that he knew was a lie before we were led to war. I mean, is this not unprecedented?
It could well be, Tom, and the answer is it could well be, and the answer is that is exactly the kind of hearing and investigation that the American people must be allowed to have.
Yeah, and I think
that's increasing. And one of the things, I want to reiterate this point, because it's not a sexy issue, and a lot of people, you know, we talk about healthcare, the environment, civil liberties. The fact of the matter is, one of the most, important responsibilities under the Constitution of the United States Congress is the issue of oversight, holding other branches of government, whether it's the Department of Defense, the Agriculture Department, the FBI, whatever it may be, accountable, not letting them do anything they want. And unfortunately, this Republican Congress has acted as a rubber stamp for the administration rather than accepting their constitutional responsibility. So the questions that you are raising, the issues that you are posing, in fact, have never, ever been seriously discussed in the House of Representatives or the U.S. Senate. And that in itself is an outrage.
Tony in San Diego, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Hello, Mr. Sanders. I have a question for you quickly. My representative in the House is Daryl Issa, and I would love to see him be replaced by a Democrat, but he just seems to be so entrenched and powerful as a Republican. Do you have any advice as to how I could help replace him with a Democrat?
Well, I think what we need, and I use this word seriously, I mean, I think we need a political revolution in this country by which people, ordinary people, get actively involved in the political process in a way that we have not seen perhaps forever. And that means people going door to door, people coming up with very strong candidates, mounting strong grassroots campaign, raising money where it is needed. The reason that bad members of Congress and the Senate are able to get reelected is they are assuming that large numbers of people, especially working people, lower-income people, are not going to vote. They are assuming that public and political consciousness is very low, so you can come up with a couple of ads or some negative attacks on your opponent and you will suddenly win. They are assuming that ordinary people do not have information about the most important issues affecting their lives, that they're not registered to vote, that they're not prepared to go out and knock on doors. And that is what we have got to change in every political district in this country. And if we do that, I think we can make huge, huge gains. In my view, the ideology of President Bush and his right-wing Republican friends represents the interest of a small number of Americans, usually the most wealthy and most powerful in this country. And if we can mobilize the middle class and working families, we should be able to take back government for the American people.
Well said. George in Tacoma, Washington. George, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, I was going to bring up the question again of minimum wage. In Washington, Oregon, you have the highest minimum wage in the country. If the Democrats get back in, are they actually going to address these raises in the federal minimum wage?
Yes, George.
Or are they just going to talk about it?
No. I think the issue is not whether, first of all, I'm not a Democrat, and I don't want to speak for the Democratic leadership.
No, I know.
But
I mean,
Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid that question. But no question. So I'm very, very mistaken, and I'm not. They will raise the minimum wage. The idea of a $5.15 minimum wage, which has not been raised in over 10 years, whose purchasing power is now lower than it has been in decades, that is pathetic, and that will change. Now, the real question you should be asking is, how high will that minimum wage go? That it will be raised? Absolutely. How high will it go? Well, that's the debate that we have to have. I know that in the state of Vermont, the minimum wage now is $7.25 an hour. I think in a few other states, it may be higher than that. But our goal must be that if somebody works 40 hours a week, that individual does not live in poverty. And that means moving toward a living wage rather than just a minimum wage.
You know, you're echoing Teddy Roosevelt. The Republican Roosevelt, that we must have a living wage in the United States.
Well, they would throw him out of the Republican Party today, that I could tell you.
You're absolutely right. We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders. It's our regular Brunch with Bernie segment here on the Tom Hartman radio program. Our number 1-866-440-8466. We'll be back with your phone calls and more right after this. It's 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Listening to the Tom Hartman program.
Bring them back from the rack, cause they never should have gone. It was wrong all along to a child, and the price.
Castle Bay is high there. They shouldn't have to die there. Shoot them back from the rack. Bring them back.
Welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Just for the record, a news update. John Dean just testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee. He said, and I quote, had the Senator House or both censured or somehow warned Richard Nixon, the tragedy of Watergate might have been prevented. Hopefully the Senate will not sit by while even more serious abuses than Watergate unfold before it. John Dean speaking. We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders. Our Brunch with Bernie segment, Danny in Durham, North Carolina. You're live with Congressman Sanders.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Mr. Sanders. Okay. I had a question and a statement. I'm from Texas, and I kind of vaguely understand what happened with what Tom DeLay did in restructuring the voting districts. And it just, as a Democrat, seems kind of helpless. You know, I feel helpless, like maybe it's not even worth doing anything, but I want to do something. And the first thing that comes to my mind is in my little hometown in Texas of about 33,000 people, I guarantee you right now, if you took a poll, 90% of the people wouldn't know where to vote, when to vote, and what to vote on. And, you know, I feel like I've gotten lucky in the past, in my ability to vote. You know, just had a friend who told me, oh, wow, you know, this is when this is happening. So, I mean, that's just my statement, my question.
Well, Dan, stay on for a minute, because you raise a very important point. And I think that believe me, that is not only true in Texas, that is true in many parts of the United States of America. And that is a very sad state of affairs when we talk about being a democratic society that most people, or not most people, but many people, often poor people, don't understand how the political process works, how they can even register to vote, how they can cast their vote, and so forth and so on. I think there's no simple answer to that except that we have to work very hard to make election law as simple as possible, to make it clear to people that in a democracy, voting is not only a right, it's an obligation. That's what democracy is supposed to be about, to make election law such that we encourage people to vote rather than discourage people to vote. But I think the immediate task is to get the word out to people how they can register, help people. There are some instances where in churches people are just walking in mass right over to the registration board or whatever it may be called in Texas, lining up and signing up to vote. And helping people know when Election Day is and how they can cast their ballot. So we have a lot of work to do in that direction, but you're absolutely right at pinpointing a very serious problem.
And you said you had a question, Danny.
Well, exactly what was it that Tom DeLay did help to do with that money he allegedly, I guess, he funneled to
what
change?
He did,
well, exactly. Could you explain that to me? And
sure.
I appreciate
as
it. Thank
best
you.
As I can understand it, he violated the fact Texas law. He used money that came from corporations, which is in violation of Texas law, to gerrymander the Texas legislature to make it more favorable to Republicans so that they, in fact, could win seats, and that, in fact, happened. So he is in violation of Texas law for improperly using money that he should not have been using for that process. Okay, and that's... And the result of that was the Republicans won. They gerrymandered the district. They created new districts which worked for Republicans in congressional elections. And they picked up, I think, Tom, what was it, 5 more seats out of that whole process?
I believe so, 5 or 6.
Which is, needless to say, very significant in the whole U.S. Congress situation.
Yeah. Brent in Spartanburg, South Carolina. Hey, Brent.
Hi, I'm a first-time caller. I'm a truck driver. And the question
And thanks for listening on Sirius.
Hello?
Yeah, I said, and thanks for listening on Sirius Satellite Radio.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. It's kind of hard for me to hear in the truck. But the question I have is, couldn't there be legislation passed that companies that sell their products in the United States from other countries be made to pay their workers a living wage there, would solve a ton of problems, seems to me.
Whether or not you could, the answer is probably you could do that, which suggests that any product sold in the United States has got to be made by a worker who earns a certain wage. Yeah, theoretically, I guess you could do that. I would approach that problem a little bit differently. I wouldn't go in that direction, but theoretically, yeah, you could say that if a product comes into the United States as part of our trade policy, workers who produce that product have got to be paid a certain wage. The answer is, I think, yes.
Okay. Kelly in Blythe, California. Hey, Kelly.
Hello. I'm also picking up on Sirius Satellite Radio, and it's a good appreciate the opportunity to talk to you.
Thank you.
Congressman Sanders, I just wanted to make a couple of points. One, a couple of previous callers, I appreciate the comment you've made that we as Democrats and maybe even independents need to get out the vote. There's no doubt about that. But I also want to say that we have done that, and we have put Democrats in Congress, in the House and the Senate. And I have been a lifetime Democrat for the 25 years that I've been eligible to vote, and I tell you what, I'm tired of the Democrats because you guys cannot get your act together. Yes, it's our responsibility to put you in office, but then it's your responsibility to do something. And when
Kelly,
excuse me,
Bernie's not a Democrat.
Oh, I assumed he was.
No, he's an independent. He's the only member of the House of Representatives who is not a Democrat and not a Republican. He's an independent.
Okay. I appreciate what you're saying. I have not.
But he started the Progressive Caucus, which is where the best Democrats hang out.
I picked up you late in the show. I just turned you on. I just assumed because everybody's talking about the Democratic Party.
Yeah. Kelly, we got to wrap it up. Bernie, final words. We got a few seconds.
Well, let me just reiterate. In the next 6 months, to a significant degree, what's going to happen for our kids and grandchildren is going to be decided in this election. And I hope people focus on it. I hope people get out and work and elect the best people that we can.
Well said. Bernie Sanders, Bernie.org, the website for more information. Be sure to check it out. It's 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on the Tom Hartman Radio Program. We'll be back after the news at the top of the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to our program. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Peter Pitts is on the line with us. He's the director of the Center for Medicine in the Public Interest. The website drugwonks.com or cmpi.org. Peter, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. How you doing?
I'm great. Center for Medicine in the Public Interest, it evokes a Ralph Nader phrase, sort of like citizens, the public interest, the various things. But it seems from the position you're advocating of health savings accounts that you're really working in the interest of the insurance and banking industries.
Well, not at all. In fact, we do no business at all and take no money from the insurance or the banking industries. We think health savings accounts are a good idea because it gives certain members of the population a good choice. We believe that people should be more empowered to deal with their health care, and certain members of the population, health savings accounts are right for them.
Aren't those certain members of the population people who have very high incomes?
No, it's actually people that have jobs. You know, people that have jobs and their employers offer health savings accounts get as much, if not more, money towards their health care than people that have traditional insurance, but they have more choice over how to use them. But, you know, what we're really keen on, you know, the major focus of CMPI is to make sure that medicine advances in the 21st century so that we deal more with acute care, rather less with acute care, more with chronic care, so people can be healthier. Health savings accounts is one good way to pay for it.
Well, the goal of early diagnosis and all that sort of thing is a laudatory goal, but my understanding of a health savings account is that I can put a couple of $1,000 a year aside. I get a tax deduction for it. Instead of paying $7,000, $8,000, $9,000, $10,000, I mean, between me and my employer right now, I think my health insurance is around $10,000. The average in the United States is $10,500. You know, whatever it is. Instead of paying that, I pay $4,000 or $5,000 for a high deductible policy, and then when I actually have to use the health insurance, I then dig into my health savings account and I pay for my health care with that. But I'm paying for it with dollars that weren't taxed. Is that a good summary of how it works?
Well, every plan is different, but that's a good place to start. Basically, yeah, you pay for health care out of pre-tax dollars, and you control how those dollars are spent.
Right. So now, how does that benefit the 50% of uninsured adults who are working, people who have jobs, and pay no federal income taxes because they're making so little money in their jobs? And many of these people actually have full-time jobs that a tax deduction is absolutely meaningless to them, much less having the ability to set aside $2,000 a year for health and for health care.
Well, that's my point earlier, that health savings accounts are good for some members of the population, not so good for others. Clearly, if you fall into a population where putting that money aside isn't a viable alternative, then it does not work for you. But no one solution works for every member of the population. That's why you've got to focus in on government programs, private programs together, and find out what programs are best for discrete portions of the population. You're absolutely right.
But again, it seems to me that this is something that will only benefit, you know, folks in the high end, which, you know, and I understand that would be why, for example, Republicans in the House and the Senate would be pushing it. You know, the Commonwealth Fund did a study, and they found that 45%, more than two-fifths, 45% of individuals with high deductible plans and 31% in CDHPs spent 5% or more of their income in out-of-pocket costs plus premiums. In other words, people with what you're suggesting, a high deductible insurance program and a health savings program, were spending more of their income on out-of-pocket expenses and premiums compared with only 12% for people with comprehensive health plans.
Well, that's a lot of numbers and a lot of acronyms, but, you know, basically some HSAs, health savings accounts, have high deductibles, others don't. You know, again, it works for some people, it doesn't work for others. You know, to paint it, you know, one way for one portion of the population is simply not fair. You know, the general philosophy is, and this is really the argument point, is whether or not you feel people should have the ability to spend their health care insurance dollars the way they see fit rather than how some insurance company sees fit.
But if I'm having a heart attack and I'm dialing 911, I'm not going to be saying, by the way, I have a health savings account and I have to spend my own health dollars very carefully. While you're sending the ambulance, actually even before you send the ambulance, can you tell me the five ambulance companies in town, which one is cheapest coming to my area? I mean, isn't that silly?
Yeah, it is silly, and it's also not really to the point. You know, those situations happen, and you have to deal with them quickly. Health savings accounts don't even necessarily mean that you've got to pre-clear things. You know, emergencies are emergencies and are dealt with accordingly. This, you know, that's not how most health care in this country happens. Most health care, you know, is taken on a very methodical basis by consumers, and that's the way it has to be addressed. You know, again, pointing out to extreme circumstances, you know, make really great political sound bites, but at the end of the day, it doesn't advance America's health, and, you know, that's why the point is all options have to be considered, and to, you know, try to score political points off of this really isn't the right way to go. The right way to go is to try to get most people as many options as they possibly can to fit their most personal circumstances.
We're talking to Peter Pitts, the director of the Center for Medicine and the Public Interest, cmpi.org, the website. Peter, there's something missing in the equation here for me. Medicare has an overhead cost of between 2 and 3%. 2.5% is the number that is the average over the last 8 years or so. Of $100 that goes through Medicare, $97.50 actually goes to health care. Why, if we were going to try to insure more people, if we're going to try and increase the coverage, the number of people who have access to health care in the United States, why would we want to go with a health savings plan where we now have a bank involved? You know, and they're going to be skimming something off the top, or they wouldn't be in the business. We have a health insurance company involved. They're going to be skimming something off the top, or they wouldn't be in the business. They've got, you know, dividends to pay to their stockholders and million-dollar salaries to pay to their CEOs. Why would we want to have all these intermediaries? Why not simply say, hey, let's just make Medicare available to every American?
Well, that's a good point. I mean, I'm not saying that health savings accounts are the best or even a viable option for people without insurance. For people without insurance, the issue is, A, like you said, every American deserves access to the highest quality health care possible. Whether that's expanding the Medicare drug benefit to the uninsured is certainly one option. It's an expensive option. You also have things that are happening in states like Massachusetts, where the governor is trying to make sure that everybody has health insurance, either in a very affordable way or in a way that the state can pay for. That's an interesting perspective, which is, how do you get, you know, the uninsured members of our population to get insurance so they can have access to the same health care everybody else has? And again, it's a question of different opportunities for different people. The problem for the lowest income groups is they have the fewest options, and that's an unfortunate reality. And
isn't that inherently wrong?
Well, I think that inherently we have a market-based system where people who have, you know, less disposable income have fewer options. And I think that that's That's just the way it is.
So you're suggesting that health care is not a right in the United States, and you don't think it should be. It's a privilege.
No, that's absolutely not what I said. I'm saying every American, absolutely every American, deserves access to the best health care that they need. But you can't give it to people in the same way. Equality.
Why not? Sweden does. England does. Canada does. France does. Germany does.
Well, that's you can say that's not true. I mean, in Europe, they believe in equality of health care. They don't believe in quality of health care. Americans deserve both.
Well, I can tell you from having lived in Germany and have for a year and used their healthcare system, from having worked in England and having used their healthcare system, I've used the healthcare system in Australia. There's at least a couple of other countries I suspect where, you know, I'd have to go back through my memory, but those stick out in my mind. I can tell you for a fact their healthcare systems work. And they're available to everybody equally. Whether you're a millionaire when you walk in the door or whether you're making $5,000 a year when you walk in the door, you get the exact same care. In fact, nobody even asks how much you make.
That's right. In fact, you know, they all get equality of care, but the quality of care is not as high as it is elsewhere in the world, like, for instance, in the United States. I mean, let's say P.J. O'Rourke used to say, if you think health care is expensive now, wait till it's free. You know,
then why do they have lower infant mortality rates? Why do they have lower death rates from long-term chronic diseases? I mean, you know, the argument is made in Canada you have to wait longer for elective surgery. Yeah, sure, elective surgery. You can also buy private insurance and you can get it quickly. If I want a nose job, you know, I'm going to have to wait. But I think that's a small price to pay for. You know, if you have a heart attack, you get surgery immediately.
Well, you know, the stats speak both ways. There's a higher mortality for breast cancer, for example, in most of Europe, you know, Great Britain especially. You know, some infant mortality, I'm not familiar with that particular stat, but certainly death from cardiovascular disease is much higher all throughout Europe because of their restrictive formularies on drugs that deal with those diseases. So, again,
There are those who suggest that the reason why is because the rate of smoking in Europe is about twice what it is in the United States, and it's killing 450,000 people a year in the United States. That's going to skew any health statistics.
That's exactly right. The point is that the stats can tell you anything you want. The point is that you can't trade equality for quality. You have to work towards a system that helps.
Okay, well, if we agree the stats can tell you anything you want, we're back to the question of why not simply say Medicare for everybody and we're going to skim 2.5% off the top to administer it rather than getting the banks involved and the health insurance companies involved.
It's not going to provide more care to more people. On the one hand, people are saying that the Part D benefit is too expensive or too generous or it's not working, and to try to expand it to tens of millions of more people, I think, puts an incredible weight on it. I think there are market-based ways that you can provide health care insurance to the entire population and give people options as to how they want their health care to be taken care of.
Then why have none of the other industrialized countries in the world embraced this? They're all looking at us like we're nuts.
Well, they're also restricting their formulators. They're crawling on our backs. And we're carrying the weight of research and development in this country, and they're free riding, and that's not fair. And
last I looked, American citizens were going to Canada to buy pharmaceuticals.
Well, last I heard, the people in Canada are using pharmaceuticals that are developed by American drug companies.
And the research for which is paid for, by and large, with the American taxpayer.
Well, not true. They're paid for by the stockholders of the pharmaceutical companies. That's a whole other conversation.
It is. It really is. Peter Pitts, the Center for Medicine and the Public Interest, CMPI.org. Peter, thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
If I told you once, must have told you twice. The last thing you're looking for is their advice. The truth you're told is just a pack of lies. The last thing you're looking for is their advice.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman Radio Program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MACS, 511-MAX. Or smalldog.com, and also the Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE, 1-888-ECO-WINE. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. on the line with us. Hey, Victoria.
Well, hey, Tom. Very quickly, I found myself thinking a great deal about what you said yesterday on immigration, and I have to admit to being quite conflicted on this issue.
Okay. Did you read the piece that I wrote on commondreams.org by any chance?
I have no computer at the moment, or at least I had no computer yesterday, so I had no access. Today I have had access. but haven't done it yet.
Okay, well, did you want to discuss that topic, or is there something
else? No, I didn't. I just wanted to tell you that you had a powerful effect on me yesterday.
Oh, well, good. I encourage you to read the piece I wrote on Common Dreams yesterday.
I will do that. In fact, I'll go to it as soon as we finish. Yeah. No, what I was going to talk about was not the immigration issue, which everybody else is talking about, but the censure issue. There was
yes.
a hearing this morning before the Senate Judiciary Committee at which John Dean, among others, he's one of my heroes, testified. And Orrin Hatch of Utah is giving the impression that Democrats are just trying to score political points. He used that phrase. Arlen Specter, the chairman of the committee, is saying that he doesn't think that it is appropriate to censure the president, but that he thinks it's appropriate to start to talk about these issues in greater depth. Meantime, Senator Feingold continues to say that the president should be censured, and John Dean, whose book, you probably interviewed him on his book, Watergate, yes, I have too, was extremely strong in this, and in fact says that he's gone far further than President Nixon did.
Yeah, now, in his testimony this morning before the Senate, John Dean said, had the Senate or House or both censured or somehow warned Richard Nixon, the tragedy of Watergate might have been prevented. He said, hopefully the Senate will not sit by while even more serious abuses unfold before it. What was the response of the senators? Are the Republicans just doing the traditional Republican thing of, we've seen this so often, you know.
I know nothing, I see nothing, and I say nothing.
Is that what they're up to, or are they taking this seriously? It sounds like Arlen Specter is.
Arlen Specter is. I think a couple of others are. I think they're taking it seriously because they realize that Feingold is a serious guy. They know Feingold, and he is a serious guy. But there's a piece of them that also wouldn't mind the Democrats introducing a censure motion because they don't believe that Democrats will sign on to it. Only two, Barbara Boxer and Tom Harkin, as you know, have so far. They think that it would flush Democrats out and force them to take a stand that could damage them politically. Now, there's another school of thought, which is that the Democrats taking a stand on this issue would actually help them politically.
Yeah, I talked with Ron Wyden this morning, and I said, what are you going to do?
Oh, what's he say?
Let's be counted here, sir. And he said he's going to pay very careful attention to the hearings today. And he said he would not rule out signing on to the motion with Feingold if, during the hearings, in his opinion, evidence is presented that the president did things worthy of censure.
I
suspect a lot of Democrats are feeling that way.
I think they are feeling that way. So then they have to have the kind of hearings into the wiretapping that will enable them to find out what really went on. And they're clearly not going to get any answers from Alberto Gonzalez, the attorney general. It's very unlikely that they'll be able to force anybody from the executive branch to come and testify. So it's going to be difficult for them to find out exactly what went on. Maybe some whistleblowers, maybe former employees.
So we're going to have, in all probability, a charade.
If we have anything, it looks at the moment like it might be a charade. I think Arlen Specter would like more than that. I think he recognizes that this is not going to rest unless there is a genuine hearing. But unless the hearing waits until, say, December.
Or January, yeah, right.
I think you're right. I mean, if I were a Democrat, I might be thinking in terms of let's just wait.
Well, actually, if I was a Democrat, I'd be thinking, let's use the censure motion right now to expose the crimes of this administration, and then in January, let's have the impeachment hearing.
Well, I think you're going a bit further than most of the senators who are very nervous about the I word. Very nervous indeed. I think they feel that censure is as strong as it should go. John Dean, of course, as you said earlier, not feeling that at all. I think they should get on with it. And obviously Feingold feeling that way. And it's so fascinating how the Democrats have not seemed to be sticking their fingers in the air to get a sense of which way the wind's blowing, but are not seeing that Democrats and independents want them to stand up for something, sort of anything.
These Democratic politicians have been listening to Bob Shrum too long. I mean, Bob Shrum should be deported. Now, that'll show up on Drudge tomorrow, right?
Oh, that's the
Hartman says Shrum should be deported. The advice, the political advice, these inside the Beltway political advisors who, Shrum, Carville, Begala, the whole bunch of them who have been giving advice to these guys for the last 20 years, it's a train wreck.
Yes.
It's just an absolute train wreck. It's as you said, lick their finger and stick it up in the air and see, what should it be. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
It's 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. We'll be back.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Leroy lives in a cardboard box down by the Mission Bell, where saints refuse to go and the sinners wish him well. Forced to carry his own cross while we drive nails in his coffin. You might say it is routine. It happens far too often.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you on the True People's Radio. And now,
behind enemy lines.
Oop! Wrong one! Sorry about that.
Now, the delay political death watch.
You gotta push the right button, Hartman. Tony Rudy, a former top aide to Representative Tom DeLay, has agreed to plead guilty to charges in the widening federal investigation of lobbyist fraud, CBS reports. Rudy would be the first person to plead guilty to charges in the case since Jack Abramoff. And it looks like Rudy is singing, as they say, as CBS News reports. Rudy was referred to in court papers released in connection with Abramoff's plea. The documents refer to Rudy as Staffer A, and said that Abramoff, on behalf of clients who wanted to stop Internet gambling and postal rate legislation, paid $50,000 in 10 equal monthly payments beginning in June 2000 to Rudy's wife, while Rudy was a top aide to Tom DeLay. Surprise, surprise! A corrupt person working in the office of one of the most corrupt members of the United States House of Representatives, and to the best of my knowledge, at this moment, the only one who is under indictment for a felony. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, Dick in Dayton, Ohio. Hey, Dick, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I am great, but I'll get better, Dick. How about you?
You're a great American, Tom.
Thank you, sir. What's up?
I was just telling your screener I wanted to go on a little different aspect on the Great Lakes,
Mm-hmm.
The shipping idea. I was just wanting to say, I got a call from up there at Lake Erie, I say we preserve our lighthouses on the Great Lakes, Tom, for the shipping,
Okay.
I say that we use them because the state can't afford them anymore, and they were going to go over to the government. I just hope they don't do that.
Dick, is this a serious call?
Pardon me?
Is this a serious...
Yeah, I just thought I'd change the subject a little bit.
Well, that's fine. What am I missing? What are you talking about here, Dick?
I'm just talking about I just don't want the government to take over the lighthouses on the Great Lakes.
Government's already running the lighthouses on the Great Lakes.
Right. That's my point.
Okay. That's... note Dick and no more Dicks from Dayton. Alan in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Alan, what's up? Alan, you're live and on
the air. Yeah. In Seattle, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can.
Well,
and I hope you're more coherent than Dick. Dick seems to have a coherence problem.
I'm not calling to talk about lighthouses, no.
Yeah.
It's pretty funny. Well, I just, the guy who was talking about healthcare, Peter.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just so fascinating to hear these guys parse the argument. It's always about, who has the most money, and they refuse to just admit that.
Well, he started out by saying this will help certain Americans.
Well, I suppose...
It will help certain Americans. If you make millions or billions, it gives you a little more of a tax deduction.
Well, I suppose it does help certain people, but the point is that this country can afford to pay for universal health care if they would just allocate their resources. It's all about priorities.
We're already paying for national health care. We just don't have it. I mean, right now, as a nation, we are paying almost twice as much for health care as any other nation in the world. And of the 37 fully industrialized democracies in the world, 36 of them are providing health care to all of their citizens, virtually all of them, for half of what we spend on health care in the United States. And by pretty much any measure, the quality of health care that they're getting is at least as good and in many cases better than we're getting right here.
Well, that's the point. I mean, how many people do you know or do you hear of that live without health care? I mean, it is phenomenal in a country with this amount of wealth.
Yeah.
But it's not people's priority. The priority is to make money for people who want to, you know, live at the top of the food chain.
No, you're absolutely right.
I mean, look at the money we're wasting in Iraq. I mean, look at the phenomenal waste of that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it astounds me how people can't look at that and understand.
Yeah. No, I'm right there with you, Alan, and thank you for the call.
Hey, listen, one more thing. Got a quick one.
Yeah.
On Musai.
As long as it's not about lighthouses, yeah.
No, Musai. They're gonna. You know, now they're blaming him for not. They're blaming him for 9/11.
You're talking about Musawi?
Yeah.
The guy who testified against himself while he was wearing the stun belt in court last week.
Yeah. Well, they can't take responsibility for their actions. Now they're gonna say if he had not lied, 9/11 wouldn't have happened.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
Bush had the information.
And Bush is now saying that the insurgency is because of Saddam. Everything is somebody else's fault with this administration.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
Thanks, Tom.
Alan, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. Richard in Bellingham. Hey, Richard.
Hey, Tom. Hey, first-time caller, long-time listener, and just have to say you're the closest thing to fair and balanced there is on commercial radio.
Well, thank you. I think that's a compliment.
Yeah, absolutely. It really is. No, I mean, you know, you do give the other side a fair chance to express themselves, and that's rare on either side. So.
Yeah, unfortunately, they rarely make a coherent point, and it's...
but at least we have a chance to know that they're truly incoherent.
There you go.
Listen, Tom, on the health care issue, I live in Bellingham, Washington, so we're real close to Canada.
Yeah.
And a couple points on the Canadian system and then, you know, on some of the things that we need to look out for. You know, our health care system is deeply flawed and in sorry need of repair, but we need to be careful that we're not adopting a model in our idealism that, in fact, has problems that we may not want to confront down the road after we adopt it. The only real safety valve for Canada, for people that can't get the care they need, is the United States. They, in fact, with the exception of one or two provinces, cannot buy private insurance to take care of things that they can't get taken care of in a timely fashion up there. That is true in England, in the English system, but it's not true in the Canadian system.
Well, the English system, the Canadian system are different in a whole lot of ways. The English system, the government actually owns and runs the hospitals and the clinics, and the doctors are government employees. My understanding
right.
is in the Canadian system, it's more of a single-payer system. And there is a huge debate in Canada about, nationwide now going on right now, about whether or not they should legalize private health insurance. I mean, basically, I think when they threw it out, it was, these guys are parasites. Let's get them out of here.
Right.
I agree with you that there is a place for private health insurance. The problem is... It's sort of like, you know, right now we have a public school system in the United States, and we want to encourage public education, and we want to have high quality public education.
Right.
But we really have a two-tiered education system because we have private schools, and people who have a lot of money, they send their kids to private schools.
Mm-hmm.
The vast majority of people that I've known in my life who have a net worth over $1 million never went to a public school in their lives. And because they, you know, they came from a family that had that kind of money, and on it goes. And I'm not talking a small number of people. I mean, you know, it's just we have a two-tiered education system in the United States. And I think what the Canadians were trying to do was to prevent that from happening with regard to health care. And I believe that you're right, Richard. There is at a certain level, you can't stop that. All you can do is mitigate the damage to it. And in the United States, with regard to education, to draw that analogy, you've got conservatives saying, oh, well, you know, we should have a voucher system where we give everybody a $2,000 voucher. And they can choose what school they want to go to. But the fact of the matter is that the average cost to educate a child in the United States is $5,600 a year. So basically what they're saying is we're going to give a further tax break to those people who are sending their kids to private schools. And if you go to a public school, tough luck. And that's going to deteriorate the public schools.
Right.
And the Canadians are very concerned that if the private insurance is done in a way similar to that, particularly if there's any subsidy associated with it, or if it's, for example, tax deductible, or if it becomes a deductible expense for employers, that they will be creating the health insurance equivalent of a poorly done voucher system in the United States, and they will end up with basically a dual health care system where only the very poor are using the state system, and thus you end up with a real mess.
But in Canada, Tom, what you're seeing is and I think this is a major caution as we try to find a better alternative than we have, is when you democratize the healthcare system and make it a government program, the money will flow to where the votes are. And the votes are with the essentially healthy majority, the people that don't need extraordinary care, that get the sniffles, that want to have a checkup, that need medications, but that the small minority of people that need serious major intervention end up getting shortchanged because they represent so few votes.
So I disagree. I think that I can't speak from personal experience with regard to Canada. I've never used their healthcare system, but we've had a number of Canadians call into this program. And for 10 years, I lived an hour and a half from the Canadian border and spent a fair amount of time in Canada. And when I lived in Vermont, in Vermont, we had every week in Montpelier, in the city that I lived in, every week there was a bus that was organized for people to go to Canada to get health care and to get drugs. And to the best of my knowledge, there are no buses being organized in Montreal to bring people down to Vermont to get health care.
Actually,
in fact, I've never heard of it happening.
2 years ago in Bellingham, a Canadian girl was visiting a church with her family, and she was hit by a car coming out of the church, very, very badly injured. We ended up having to take a collection in our community to pay for her transport back to Canada because her family was poor, and Canada would not pay for her health care while she was in the United States. She had to be in Canada.
Well, that's a flaw in the system. That,
sure.
I agree with that. It's a flaw in the system.
Another thing you were chatting about, Tom, and then I'll
But let me just add, Richard, when I was in England, one of our kids got sick, and the doctor actually came to the home of the people we were staying with, took care of our daughter, gave her antibiotics, and wouldn't take any money for it.
Right, right. Well, the other thing you mentioned is, when we look at infant mortality rates and some of those other measures of health.
Richard, I got to ask you to hold on that thought, okay? If you want to pursue this, hang on just a second. We'll be back. Our telephone number 1-866-440-8466. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Truth in Broadcasting for a Change.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour, it's the Tom Hartman program. Progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. And if... No, I can't. Not even try to do claims. Welcome back, Richard in Bellingham, Washington. Richard, you had one more question. You had one more point.
Yeah, Tom. I just wanted to say that as we search for ways to make our health care distribution system more fair and equitable, we should not kid ourselves that solving the problem with financing and distribution of health care is going to have much of an effect on some of the public health measurements like infant mortality, life expectancy. Those things are driven, I think, far more by broader inequalities in our society, the remnants of slavery and the fact that we're willing to tolerate pockets of third world living conditions in our society.
I don't disagree with you at all, but I would suggest that healthcare is, just like access to food, just like access to housing, just like access to clean water, access to health care is part of the essential infrastructure of our nation, and it's being badly, badly ignored.
Absolutely. Yeah. We just need to make sure as we solve it, we don't expect too much out of our solution.
There you go. Well said. Yeah, thanks a lot, Richard. I got to move along. Jennifer in Pittsburgh. Hey, Jennifer, what's up?
Hi.
Hi.
How you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's on your mind, Jennifer?
A few years ago when I was a graduate student, I was in Italy performing with an opera program and had the great fortune of stepping out of a restaurant and feeling my ankle just pop. And I couldn't believe that. They took me to the hospital, and I'd never got a bill for anything, even though I was not a citizen of their country, got perfectly good care, nice doctors, didn't wait very long. I just could not believe that. And now, having a similar injury, I go to the doctor. I was only lucky that I was working for a, on a job where there was workers' compensation.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, I wouldn't have been able to go to the doctors at all. Because, I mean, even with, like, a master's degree, right now I'm working two jobs plus gigging as a musician, which none of which offers any health insurance. So it's I can't believe it. I have to, if I get hurt, the first thing I have to worry is, like, oh, God, how am I going to pay for it?
Right. Which brings us all back to Ricardo's iron law of wages, which I'll talk about in the next hour. But, yes, absolutely. In fact, I've seen this all around the world. Others, you know, I just got an email from somebody here who says, my son was in Argentina a month ago and was bitten by a dog. He visited an emergency room at a local hospital where he received excellent treatment. The bill was $1.33 U.S.
Oh, my God.
And when I was in Australia 3 years ago and I got really bad food poisoning, I went to the local, you know, clinic, kind of, you know, doc-in-a-box kind of thing, walk in, and it cost me $20. You know, it was basically like the copay, you know, and they gave me the drugs for food poisoning and whatever, and it was, and I just walked in, you know. It's have a seat. The doctor will see you in 15 minutes. Jennifer, thanks a lot for the call.
All right, thanks. Bye-bye.
Good to hear from you and to have you weigh in on it. I mean, this is not rocket science. It's other countries do this. We're not hearing... Yes, we're hearing debates in other countries about how to fine-tune their systems. You know, there's a debate in the UK about, you know, gee, we're not spending enough on this, for example. There's a debate in Canada about whether or not they should allow private health insurance and to what extent. And is this going to create a two-tiered system? Sure. But there is not a single country in the world, not one, well, other than Iraq, that is looking at us and saying, oh, gee, let's do it the way the Americans are doing it. It just is not happening. It just is not even close to happening. By the way, in other news for the day, just a quick recap, this Think Progress, their great summary, their Think Fast summary. The Army has now said to our GIs in Iraq, many of whom, because of the lack of body armor, here, still 3 years into the war, they still don't have body armor, many of our GIs. And so their families are buying it and sending it to them. So what's happened is there's this whole industry here in the United States of people manufacturing body armor to sell to families to send to their kids over in Iraq. The Army has said that if you have privately purchased body armor in Iraq, you cannot use it. You cannot use it. And veterans groups across the United States, absolutely livid. This is outrageous. But the Army is saying basically, sorry, you can't use it. No, we don't have any to give to you, but you can't use what you got. Why don't we have it to give to you? Well, because we're working on the Bush private enterprise system. We're letting you know, private corporations deal with all this stuff, and they'll figure it out. And Blackwater now has one of a number of companies, actually, I believe, that are suggesting that in addition to just security services, they may be at some point available for combat services, the privatization of our armies. Is this really what we want? Now, on top of this, in a letter, President Bush urged Iraqi Shiite Ayatollah al-Sistani to get more involved in negotiations over Iraq's new government. Now, this is the same time that in the New York Times today, there was a story about how George W. Bush says that the current prime minister of Iraq is a guy he really doesn't want him in there, doesn't think he should be the prime minister. And so you've got the prime minister of Iraq going, hey, wait a minute, quit picking on me, you know, why are you trying to blow me out of here? And now Bush going to Sistani saying, hey, help us out. Sistani, quote, laid the letter aside unread, end quote. It's a letter from the President of the United States because of increasing unhappiness over heavy-handed U.S. meddling in Iraqi negotiations. Bush is making a bad situation worse. We kicked over this hornet's nest. We created a disaster, and now he is making it worse. It's what he did with Armbusto oil. It's what he did with Texas, certainly. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to the program where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. A couple of weeks ago, one of our callers asked Bernie Sanders, what should I do? You know, I've got $100. I got a little money. I want to help somebody out. I want to do something. What should I do? Should I send it to the Democratic Party? Should I send it to some organization? Should I buy a TV ad, you know, or contribute to it? Or what should I do? And Bernie said, find the most progressive candidates in the United States. Go out and find the most progressive candidates that you can in the United States and support them individually. And that's what we're doing on this program. This is part of our ongoing Taking My Country Back, only this time without the music. We'll do that once a week. Our Taking My Country Back program. And on with me now is Nancy Skinner. Her website's skinnerforcongress.com. And I'm putting my money where my mouth is. A couple of weeks ago when I got it that Nancy was running and running a serious campaign, I went to her website and sent her a little bit of money. I mean, it's not a whole lot. I'm not a rich guy, but I encourage you to do the same thing. Skinner for Congress is her website. Nancy, welcome to the program.
Well, Tom, thanks for having me. You and I go way back out there as progressive voices in the wilderness, so I'm great to hear of your success, and thank you for having me on to talk about my congressional run.
Well, I think it's marvelous that you're doing it, Nancy. And, yeah, for the listeners who may be wondering what you're talking about, you and I were both on IE America Radio Network, which was really the first liberal talk radio network in the United States, and you did a great show. You just did a great show, and there's no doubt in my mind that you will be a great member of Congress for Michigan's 9th District. You are running against an incumbent who is almost a Tom DeLay clone. I mean, this guy, he's taken money from Trimpac. He's taken money from Tom DeLay. He's voted with DeLay over 90% of the time. He's voted with the president over 90% of the time. Do the people in your district get this?
They're starting to. That's the good news. They're starting to. He's kind of been in the district below the radar screen. But, you know, I don't know if you've seen the headlines today, Tom, but the Delphi, the largest U.S. auto supplier, went into bankruptcy court in New York today and said they wanted to void their union contracts, not pay for retirees' pension and health and medical benefits. And the UAW, and I'm proud to say I was just recently endorsed 2 days ago by the UAW here.
Congratulations.
Thank you. But I know the folks well. We will have the president of the UAW said he'll have no choice but to strike. And what that means is that General Motors itself will be shut down, Tom. There is just huge news here, and it's like a slow motion Katrina economically that the rest of the country doesn't understand here. We can't not have the auto industry. It's not just any other industry. President Bush came to town a couple weeks ago and said, we can't help you. There's nothing that we can do to help you. Well, so what people are waking up saying, something has to be done here. And one of my major plank, and we'll get into this at skinnerforcongress.com, but it's to help green the industry. The way to help the auto industry, Tom, is to provide tax credits for hybrid vehicles and fuel cell vehicles and flex fuel vehicles and a purchase of 50,000 hybrid vehicles from the government. That's an immediate shot in the arm. We need to do that. Because, as you know, you follow the oil situation. President Bush says we have to end our oil addiction. Half of it comes from transportation, half of it.
Yeah.
So the federal government does have a role here, and as we're in crisis, this is the way out. So this is the issue that people are starting to listen to. But it is, let me say about the district, it's a 50-50 district. This is what people have to know. Our governor, Jennifer Granholm, God bless her, she's like a female Bill Clinton. She's fabulous. She won the district. and John Kerry got 49% of the district. So we don't have many districts in America that are 50-50 with a female candidate who has some name recognition and strong support from, you know, across labor and the governor's office. The governor's husband was on my show every Friday here. I was the morning host at 1310 a.m. Detroit's Progressive Talk for the last year, so I have a strong base in the area. So we have every opportunity to win this seat. But I do need a push today. You mentioned fundraising. Today is the final day for the quarter fundraising deadline. And all the big groups like Emily's List, who's been working with me, and the DCCC, they all look at how much you can raise to show that you're a credible candidate. So we've been working so hard, Tom, to get that in. And, you know, 10, 20, 50, if you have that $100 you mentioned, to go to our website at skinnerforcongress.com and contribute that sends a message that we want progressive candidates and we can win, Tom.
I agree. And this is taking back. We get people calling this program and they're like, oh, my God, look at what Tom DeLay is doing. And look at what are the Republicans. They won't invest. They won't impeach Bush. They won't even let Rush Holt's voting bill, you know, the make voting machines a little cleaner out of committee. And, you know, quack, 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 quack. And it's not individual members of Congress that are the problem. It's the fact that the Republicans control the House of Representatives. And you're in a district where you have a Republican who has been successful in doing in Michigan what Gordon Smith has done here in Oregon, which is pretend that he's not there when he's voting a hard right agenda back in Washington, D.C. You know, kind of pretend that he's sort of a moderate or else simply stay below the radar screen. And this guy needs to go.
Yeah.
And Nancy Skinner needs to replace him. SkinnerForCongress.com is the website. You know, I don't want this to sound like an NPR fundraiser, Nancy, but I absolutely agree with you that if people want people who have nothing, you know, have never even been in Michigan, if you want to be part of taking Congress back so that John Conyers can actually have subpoena power to impeach George W. Bush, then we need to get Democrats into the Congress. And Nancy Skinner is a good shot at it. And Skinner for Congress, forcongress.com, is a great place to start. And as you said,
Tom, let me just, for people who don't know the incumbent, his name is Joe Nolenberg, they'll know this one. You know, remember the biggest pork bill we've had in history with all the earmarks in it that passed in the transportation bill?
Right.
Everyone, the bridges to nowhere, everyone
sure
remembers that, right? That was Joe Nolenberg's bill. He's the chairman of the Appropriations Committee, the Subcommittee on Transportation. That was his baby. So that's how you'll know him, the largest pork bill in history. And he put the New York Times published this on December 11th. He put an $8.3 million earmark in the bill, and it went to force Amtrak to carry around fruits and vegetables. You know how Republicans generally hate Amtrak? This was forcing them to lose more money. But the problem was the recipient of this earmark was his second largest donor, only one company.
Gee, what a surprise.
Yeah, imagine that.
I am shocked.
And when the New York Times published it, he was forced to go and repeal the earmark.
So you're running against a guy who not only is a Republican who votes with Bush and DeLay the vast majority of the time. I'm talking the vast majority. We're talking
90% Bush, 93% DeLay.
Yeah, not only that, but you can't call him a crook because what he did is legal. But he's not. Certainly, he doesn't reflect the values of most Americans.
No,
it's
the special interest. He's from the insurance industry. That's what he was. And so he takes a lot of insurance industry money, as we saw the prescription drug benefit bill, right?
Yeah.
That was a bill written by the industry. He's the same kind of candidate, Tom. They take all the special interest money and essentially do the bidding of their constituents, which are the contributors. But it's to the detriment of our country. And until there are 15 seats, we need 15 seats to take back the House of Representatives. Mine is in play. And women candidates are the best performers right now across the country in affluent, educated districts, which is my district. We have the best chance of winning. And if we get those 15 seats back, we have the House. We will have, as you said, we will have accountability, oversight, and we need to put the wheels back on the train here badly.
There you go. There you go. We're talking with Nancy Skinner. She's running for Michigan's 9th District. Her website, Skinner, S-K-I-N-N-E-R, just like it sounds, Skinner for forcongress.com. And please check that website out. And Nancy, just very quickly, where is the 9th District? For our listeners who aren't familiar
with it. It's suburban Detroit. So it's where, you know, the home to most of the executives, management, and workforce of the entire auto industry. It's a wealthy district. We have mixed, you know, income actually, because it's blue and white collar. And if, you know, if all this news that we're hearing today, if GM goes bankrupt, I'm telling you, the ripple effect time across America, they'll wake up and hear it. So we need leadership. The federal government is doing nothing, and that's why you need to send people from Detroit to help green the industry. I will fight to help them get up the learning curve to meet the needs of the future, because we can't compete with $10,000 Chinese vehicles, you know, that they're bringing into our market here in 2007.
Oh, well, not just that. Mm-hmm. We have this mind-bogglingly insane trade policy. If General Motors wants to export a by the way, we've got a caller on the line right now who says they're trying to contribute on your website and can't. Let me just bring this person up. And no, I can't. It's
well,
not.
You
not
can go to SkinnerFCongress.com, and our contribute site, if that isn't working, go directly to ActBlue.com if there's some problem. ActBlue.com, and you can find us as well, Nancy Skinner, under the Federal Candidates tab.
Okay, and I'm gonna put that caller on right now, and we're going to bump this break back a little bit. Caller, I'm sorry I don't have your name here. But
This is Ken, ActBlue, ActBlue.
ActBlue, ActBlue.com is where we actually sign up for contributions.
And, Ken, what happened when you went to SkinnerForCongress.com?
I got to Skinner for Congress, okay, and then they got, like, three different places where you can go to the contribute page. Every one of them hung up going in.
Huh. Okay,
you know,
Nancy, you got to check your site.
Yeah, because today is the last day of the quarter, so there's a lot of activity where people are trying to get their contributions in. So you can go right to ActBlue.com in my website. Links will be restored shortly, but thank you, sir. I appreciate it. Each contribution today helps get us closer to getting the resources we need, and the national groups they think my race is winnable. They've targeted my race, Tom. This is the DCCC, but we want to show them progressives can win too.
There you go. Nancy Skinner running for the United States Congress from Michigan's 9th District, the last day to raise the money to make this thing happen, and one of the people who genuinely has a solid chance of helping us take back the House of Representatives so we can hold these guys accountable for everything they've been doing. SkinnerForCongress.com, S-K-I-N-N-E-R for Congress.com, ActBlue.com.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to the place where smart people get the news, the Tom Hartman radio program. I just wanted to say about Nancy's website, Nancy Skinner's race, Skinner for Congress, is one of the more important races in the country. And I'm wondering if what's going on is, keep in mind, this is the week that a Republican in New Hampshire pled guilty to jamming the phone banks at the local fire station and a teachers union on election day to get out the vote for Kerry. And back in the 2004 election, and he just pled guilty to, they totally slammed the phone banks, you know, using auto dialers and using a telemarketing company to call the number that these people are trying to dial out from, so it's ringing over and over and over again thousands of times an hour. And it's possible to program a computer to hit a website thousands of times a second. It's called a denial of service attack, a DOS attack, and make it so that that website doesn't work. Because I know that Nancy's website was working fine just a few days ago, because as I said, I gave her some money. And so I would say persist. Ken is going to stick around with us. We're going to go back and talk to him in just a second, and also be taking your calls in right after the bottom of the hour. But first, Jeffrey Kleinman is with us with DVD Talk. Hey, Jeffrey.
How's it going?
Good. We've got it's really weird. We've got one of the candidates, Nancy Skinner. Skinner for Congress is her website. One of the most viable Democratic candidates who could take a Republican seat, and today's the last day to raise money for her, and all of a sudden her website has gone weird.
Yeah, we've had experiences before with denial of service attacks, and you know, in the internet, there's very few people who you can call for help. And, you know, you really get into a situation where it's like you're under attack and, you know, who do you call? And the FBI won't get involved in anything unless you lose $5,000.
Yeah, yeah, and you can document it. And if you've had a denial of service attack, you can't deny it.
It's tough.
So anyhow, people can go to actblue.com if they want to contribute to Nancy Skinner's campaign and just do it directly through ActBlue, because that's what her link is pointing to. We're talking with Jeffrey Kleiman. He's the editor of DVD Talk, an online magazine, dvdtalk.com, the website. And what we can do when we're not doing politics, we get a little entertainment here. King Kong is out.
Yeah, a little escapist film here. Peter Jackson, who did the Lord of the Rings trilogy, revisits one of the classic monster movies. And it's a three-hour film. It's fantastic. It's a roller coaster ride. And the DVD, they have a two-disc special edition that has 3.5 hours of special features on it. This is just a no-brainer to pick up. But the great thing also for modern audiences is to pick up the 1933 version as well and see these two side-by-side, which is really an experience.
Hmm. And is the 33 version is also available on DVD?
Yes.
Okay, but they're not sold together as a package or anything like that.
No, two different studios. One's Warner Brothers and one's Universal. So, but both of them, it's a real great experience to watch these two films. Both of them are just very, very, very fantastic.
Memoirs of a Geisha is out on CD. This was wasn't it nominated for an Academy Award?
Yeah, it was, and it actually won a number of them in kind of the best art direction and costume space. And I think that was probably where it should win. It's an adaptation of the successful best-selling novel. And Rob Marshall, who did Chicago, does a wonderful job of painting a real pretty picture here. And it's a real beautiful film.
Mm-hmm. And also, I think, culturally informative.
Yeah. The one issue, though, that I still have with it is he cast lead female Chinese Hong Kong, some of them action stars, but lead Chinese actresses in the Japanese roles. And it's a little,
those are very different cultures.
Yeah, yeah, but they seem to pull it off.
Hmm, good. Now, Salt of the Earth, I'm not familiar with this.
This is actually from the Ironweed Progressive Film Club, and they put out a monthly DVD magazine. This month is Salt of the Earth. This was a film that was actually blacklisted. It's one of the few films that have been blacklisted and banned in the United States.
When was it first made?
I think this is, the 60s? I don't know the exact date of the film.
They were still blacklisting things in the 60s?
Was it 50s or 60s?
The 50s when the blacklist was going on.
I'm jumping time-wise.
It might have been the early 60s. I think it pretty
right
much died out
here.
In the end. Yeah.
But basically, it's an interesting film. It's more of a historical timepiece than anything else. It's basically this New Mexican mine workers, kind of struggle against this company for labor rights and also women's rights. And the neat thing about this film is the people, it's based on a true story, and the people in the film are the people from the true story. And, this union-positive film was seen as a communist manifesto, and the film was blacklisted, and all the creative people were blacklisted. And it's kind of interesting for this film to come out because we have Good Night and Good Luck on DVD that was out earlier in the month. And this is a real good companion to that.
Remarkable. Salt of the Earth, it's called.
Yep, from my
on DVD. And you can learn about that and others over at dvdtalk.com. Jeffrey Kleiman, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks. Take care.
Great talking with you, Jeffrey. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. We'll be back right after this here on the True People's Radio.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. The pill that will help you escape the matrix, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 25 minutes before the hour. Just a little of the best of the rest of the news here. The United States military plans to detonate a 700-ton explosive charge in a test called Divine Strike that will send a mushroom cloud over Las Vegas, according to a senior defense official. This is from news out of Australia, oddly enough. I don't want to sound glib here, says James Tagnelia, head of the Defense Threat Reduction Agency, but it is the first time in Nevada that you'll see a mushroom cloud over Las Vegas since we stopped testing nuclear weapons. I'm sure that's going to make the good citizens of Las Vegas very happy. They're basically testing out bunker busters. The aim is to measure the effect of the blast on hard granite structures, he said. It's going to happen the first week of June. I'm curious if they're going to drop an actual bunker buster bomb, will it be loaded with depleted uranium? The citizens of Nevada might be wanting to ask that. This from the Boston Herald about Judge Scalia. We have a rogue, out-of-control justice on the Supreme Court, Antonin Scalia. Here he is in church saying, Vaffanculo, punctuating the comment by flicking his right hand out from under his chin. The photo is now available. The guy who took the picture actually put it up for sale and then was fired. But he says still it was the right thing. He believes that he did the right thing by putting the photo out. And Scalia, by the way, he says, the judge, this is what the guy said. He says, the judge paused for a second and looked directly into my lens and said, to my critics, I say, Vaffanculo, punctuating the comment by flicking his right hand out from under his chin, Smith said. The Italian phrase means blank you. You can fill in the blank. I don't think you need me to give you much more than that. And the sign actually means the same thing. So not only did he make the sign for it, but he actually said it. And in church, this is the kind of good church-fearing, you know, God-fearing, church-going man that the Bush administration would like all Supreme Court justices to be like. At the same time, George W. Bush, the man who wants to be king of America, says he doesn't have to answer to Congress. He doesn't have to answer to the Supreme Court. He also wants to be the supreme mullah of Iraq, apparently. The Prime Minister, Ibrahim al-Jafari, has been informed, even though he was appointed by a majority of the elected members of the Iranian parliament, he was appointed prime minister. President George W. Bush has said, and I quote, he doesn't want, doesn't support, and doesn't accept al-Jafari as the prime minister. The personal message from President Bush was delivered to Abdulaziz al-Hakim, head of the Shiite political bloc, by the American ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad. This is incredible. The New York Times, an article about it today by Edward Wong. Facing growing pressure from the Bush administration to step down, Prime Minister Ibrahim al-Jafari of Iraq vigorously asserted his right to stay in office on Wednesday and warned the Americans against interfering in Iraq's political processes. Mr. Jafari also defended his recent political alliance with the radical Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, whose men, we should remind you, killed Cindy Sheehan's son, now the prime minister's most powerful backer, saying in an interview that Mr. Sadr and his militia, now thousands strong, are a fact of life in Iraq and need to be accepted into mainstream politics, which in all probability is true. Mr. Jafari said he would work to fold the country's myriad militias into the official security forces and ensure that recruits and top security ministers abandon their ethnic or sectarian loyalties. The 275-member parliament elected him. Senior Shiite politicians said Tuesday that the American ambassador, Zalmay Khalilzad, had weighed in over the weekend, telling the leader of the Shiite bloc that President Bush did not want Mr. Jafari as prime minister. This was the first time the Americans had openly expressed a preference for the post, the politicians said, and it showed the Bush administration's acute impatience. With the political logjam, relations between Shiite leaders and the Americans have been fraying for months. This is from the New York Times. According to the Constitution, the largest bloc in parliament, in this case, or the Iraqi parliament, in this case the religious Shiites, has the right to nominate a prime minister. Mr. Jafari won that nomination in a secret ballot last month among the bloc's 130 Shiite members of parliament. So, the current story from the Bush administration about why we went to war in Iraq is to bring democracy to Iraq. And Bush runs around saying, see, I told you we're doing it right. Look at, they just held an election. And we see all these pictures of people with their purple fingers stuck up in the air.
No, not the Scalia gesture, the I voted gesture. And Bush is, oh, this is wonderful. Look, isn't this great? We have democracy. The people will decide. And the people decided that they want Al-Jafari as the prime minister, and now Bush says, no, I'm not going to go along with that. We want democracy, Bush says, the way they have democracy in Ohio. You know, if you got people who are going to vote for the guy you don't want, you just cut down the number of polling places and switch them around at the last minute so that they end up standing in line for 10 hours, and then when they get to the front of the line, they're told, hey, you're in the wrong place. And you bump people off the voting lists. 300,000 people in Ohio, where John Kerry only lost by some 60,000 votes. 300,000 people in districts that went 80 to 90% Democratic, thrown off the voting rolls, inexplicably, by Ken Blackwell, the chairman of the co-chairman of the Bush-Cheney 04 committee and the Secretary of State and supervisor of all elections in the state of Ohio. George W. Bush did not win in 2000. Al Gore got more votes than he did if you did a statewide recount, as the New York Times and the Washington Post explained a year later when they actually counted the ballots. And he did not win in 2004. The election was stolen by Ken Blackwell, as John Conyers has clearly documented in his book, What Went Wrong in Ohio, the result of the hearings that he held in Congress. And that's how Bush thinks it should be done in Iraq. Hey, if you're going to have an election, steal it. But they didn't do that, apparently. They didn't rig it right. It took them, you know, there wasn't time to get the Debo machines over there. Meanwhile, speaking of Republicans, the Republican who is running to succeed Duke Cunningham, you know, Duke Cunningham out in California, he's like no longer in Congress. And so there's this right-winger who has, he's out of the California Assembly. He was in the California Assembly. He's now running for the U.S. House of Representatives. Cooligan is his name, sort of like, or Kaluigan, or Kalugian. Sort of looks like Hooligan. Anyhow, whatever his name, no, it's Kaluigian. He was the mastermind of the Davis recall. This was the guy behind the scenes who pulled all the strings to make the Davis recall happen. And now he's running to replace Duke Cunningham. And on his website, he says, I was just in Iraq, and here's a photo that I took. I mean, it's literally what he says. He posted on his official website for his campaign as a picture which was taken in, quote, downtown Baghdad during his visit to the city, which supposedly indicates that the media was wrong about the level of violence in the city. In fact, he says, we took this photo of downtown Baghdad while we were in Iraq. Downtown Iraq, including Baghdad, is much more calm and stable than many people believe it to be. But each day the news media finds any violence in the country occurring and screams and shouts about it, in part because many journalists are opposed to the U.S. effort to fight terrorism. End quote. This is what this guy, this hooligan guy, Kaluigan, says on his website. And he's got this photo of a city that looks, say, pretty peaceful. People walking down the street, men and women holding hands, women in a tank top, nothing covering her head. Well, it turns out it's a picture from Turkey. A different country! It's a different country. It's a different city in a different country. It's from Ankara, Turkey. Oh, man. It's absolutely tragic. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Glenn in Bellevue, Washington. Hey, Glenn, what's up?
I got a couple of items on immigration, and I listen to your show every day, Tom. You're doing a great service.
Thank you.
If we allow a pass to citizenship for all these illegals, which I'm hearing, 10, 11, 12, and on Lou Dobbs, 20 million, a lot of these people are going to follow that path. And
sure.
I'm looking out, maybe it's 8 or 10 years. But are they going to be allowed to, under the family unification program, to go back to Mexico and bring all their family up here?
Well, good chance. I mean, that's a program that does work for immigrants. My brother-in-law is in the process of, his wife is not, she is an immigrant into the United States, and she's in the process of obtaining U.S. citizenship. And it's taking years. But once she gets it, it'll be a lot easier for her to bring family members into the United States. in all probability. I mean, that's the rules of the game.
Aren't we going to be flooded in about...
Yes, and that's what the conservatives want. That's what the conservatives want, because as Ricardo pointed out years ago, David Ricardo, the economist, if you have an unlimited supply of labor, the price of labor will stabilize at subsistence levels. It generally won't drop below that, but as long as you have an unlimited or relatively unlimited supply of labor, the price of labor will subsidize at subsistence levels. In other words, as long as people can eat and sleep, you won't have riots, and that's what the price of labor will be. So, you know, if the conservative dream for America comes true, the average wage across the United States is going to be around $5.15 an hour. You think Walmart is bad? It's going down from there as the supply of labor increases. This is it's a simple rule of economics. I mean, Ricardo was writing this in 1813, 1814. And but absolutely, in fact, Alan Greenspan quotes this. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Bring them back from their wrath, because they never should have come here. It was war all along to attack. And the price will pay is high there. They shouldn't have to die there. Bring them back from their wrath. Bring them back. Bring them back.
Indeed, it's time. It's time now to bring them back from Iraq. By the way, Pat Leahy was just a few hours ago in the United States Senate, the Judiciary Committee hearings. Pat Leahy is the number two guy on the committee. He's the top Democrat on the committee, and because the Republicans control the Senate, the number one guy, of course, is Arlen Specter, the Republican. So here's Pat Leahy asking John Dean, who was Richard Nixon's lawyer. He held the job in the White House that Alberto Gonzalez held in the White House a year ago. He was the lawyer, the counsel to the president, the lawyer to the president, and under Richard Nixon. And so here is Pat Leahy talking to John Dean, Richard Nixon's former attorney.
But you said at the end of your written statement that today it's very obvious history is repeating itself. What do you mean by that?
Now, John Dean.
I mean by that that we've entered a period where a president is pushing the envelope. He is actually defying the Congress. Nixon writes in his memoir how he has thrown the gauntlet down after he's been reelected. I can recall well from my visits with people like Senator Sam Ervin, who were quite upset with his reorganization of the executive branch contrary to the desires of the Congress. He was testing, if you will, where he could take his policies and authorities. He found, however, that with a divided government, that it was a little rougher road to hoe. The reason history is repeating itself is because there's no check, as there has been in the past.
John Dean, history is repeating itself with the Bush administration. By the way, thanks so much to my producer. It's Friday. I want to thank everybody involved with this program. My producer, David Poole, Louise Hartman, Alex Goldmark, and Dan Jacobs at Air America New York, who work really hard every day to make this program work and run smoothly and do such a great job with it. Ben Birch, who over at White Rose Society, and Shelby LePray at radiopower.org. Sue Nethercutt, who helps run our chat room, and all the folks in our chat room. Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website. And my apologies to anybody whose name I've mispronounced. All of our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program. It's much appreciated. 1-866-440-8466, our number. Ron in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Ron, as we wrap up the show and the week, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I just came from a meeting this morning where people were bemoaning the cuts in Medicaid funding and services here in Pennsylvania,
mm-hmm.
and I imagine that's true all over the country.
It is.
I think that, the current guest worker proposal, does it have buried in it somewhere that these, when they authorize the guest workers, and, you know, when they're entitled to medical care if they're semi-permanent residents in the country here, Who's going to pay for that? Are they going to, you know, I'm sure...
You and me. Not the employers, I guarantee you. These are folks who are working at a wage level so low that they qualify for Medicaid in most states. This is like, you know, Walmart running seminars on, well, not just Walmart, a whole bunch of low-wage employers running seminars telling their employees how to make use of public services like Medicaid, food stamps, things like that. Sure, of course. This is another welfare program paid for by America's middle class for the wealthiest in America who own the companies, own the businesses, own the agriculture industry in which these people work.
That means that the existing Medicaid recipients are going to get less services because if the same amount of dollars are going to have to stretch further.
That's right. Or there will be, you know, a Medicaid crisis coming, and there'll be more hysteria coming from the Reich, and they'll be saying, "Oh well, we told you socialism doesn't work. We told you that nasty Franklin Roosevelt, he had it all wrong, and we just have to do away with Social Security, and we just have to do away with Medicare and Medicaid, and just go back to the world the way it was before Roosevelt came to power back in the robber baron era when there was no middle class."
Maybe we have a perfect storm here where the conservatives want a whole lot of low-wage workers to slave for them, and they're accusing the Democrats of wanting a whole bunch of poor people that are going to vote for Democrats. So it's...
Well, the sad thing is, you know, SEIU, for example, I talked with the executive director of the local here in the state of Oregon this morning on my local program, and they're supporting guest worker programs. And they're doing it because they hope that they'll get members. And I just, you know, I keep wanting to say, you know, the only power a union has is in limiting the availability of labor. It's not having more members. It's having a ratio of members to workers. And it's like the unions are so short. I mean, I just don't think they get it. And then you got Limbaugh, of course.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
And all of this really plays into that whole thing, this whole thing of let's take apart the New Deal, let's take apart the American middle class. The American middle class was a pesky, obnoxious thing. It was at its zenith, at its height, in the 1960s and 1970s and early 1980s, when people were out in the streets, they were protesting, the students were being uppity, and that's not anything that the cons in this country want to put up with again. Ron, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. Coming up next week, on Monday, Kevin Phillips is going to be with us to talk about American theocracy. Rick Scarborough, conservative, is going to be claiming that Christianity and government is a calling from God. It's required. And Alan Tomlinson about the race to the bottom, why a worldwide American worker or worldwide worker surplus and uncontrolled free trade are sinking America's living standards. That and more right here on the Tom Hartman radio program, the Radio Free Speech Zone. And remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. Have a great weekend. See you next week.
You have been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
Were you lucky enough to get an iPod for